And you gonna murder this one and murder that one. Talking all that bullshit. I'ma put it to you like this, yo.
This is for the nerds. This is for the brainiacs. This is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back. You ain't gonna touch me. You're not gonna do nothing. You are not above me. I bet you wish you was me. I know it, I know.
What is poppin', everybody? And welcome back to another special episode of the Only Friends Podcast. Well, you know, it's me and my only friends, which includes, but is not limited to, my boy Hunt. What's poppin', Hunt? How you feeling today?
Hey, Conrad, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm chilling. What's your week's been like?
Yeah, pretty good. Been out there in the wind streets a little bit. Played the six max yesterday.
Mm. Okay.
You battling with Bex?
Got dusted. I played like a couple of hands against him. It was funny. My first bullet, he was at my table. Then I got moved. Then I busted. He also busted. And both of us were back at the same table on our second bullet.
It's amazing how often you and Landon and J-Bex are like at the same table. It's not all three at the same time, but like some sort of combination of that.
In the last month, I think I've been at his table maybe five times or something like that, including one final table, one day two. Like it's pretty wild, honestly.
Wasn't he at your table when I showed up at the Venetian with Michelle? We were
that was the final table. Yeah, he was to my direct right. That final table. That was the one we discussed on here on the pod. So yeah, I played a lot with him lately. But
I mean, if you guys keep making final tables, you'll be at the same table.
That's the plan, right? Yeah. I mean, at least for me it is. I don't know about him, but for me it's the plan to keep making final tables.
I think so. That's his plan as well.
I would imagine so. I would imagine it would be kind of stupid to not have that plan. So
unfortunately you didn't bag. What was the turnout for it? Was it pretty big?
Yeah, I think they got like 100 and, well, at the time when I busted my second bullet and didn't fire again, they had like 160 in there, I think, yesterday alone.
Okay.
So I would guess...
They got a lot.
Yeah, maybe they ended at like 200 yesterday, and they'll probably get...
They ended at 211.
211, okay. So they probably will get, you know, 200 more today, at least, I would think. So
I would think more than that. Yeah, Landon, even in the streets, right?
Pretty big field for a 2K 6 max.
I'm 3 out of 211.
Oh, no. Oh no, that equals $6,600.
Yeah.
That sounds like max pain. How you feeling over there?
Good day to lose 2 to 12K.
That's
shout
funny.
Out to Benny P.
I was just reading Benny P's IG.
Wait,
so story.
You bagged third chips? What are you saying?
Nothing. No, he meant that three of the 211 entries were his.
Oh.
Minus 6,600 is what he said.
Yeah.
Painful
I was confused.
Day.
When you say I'm 3 of 211, I was thinking that you meant...
Nothing like losing 100 big blind pots before dinner break and then thinking like, you can't go out like this.
Yeah.
It can't end this way. It can't end this way.
Yeah, but sometimes it does. It just ends that way.
A lot of times it does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Max is nice there. It's like 7:30, right?
It's after dinner break, get 20 bigs, and like it's a good spot, but it's kind of expensive.
It's unlimited reentries until dinner break?
It's 6:40, so I think. Actually,
it's unlimited reentries for the 6 max. I don't know if it's going to be... Is it unlimited reentries for the main? The main starts tomorrow.
I feel does like it? It is. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it is.
The main starts tomorrow.
What's the main buying?
3,500.
Yeah.
3,500, 3 million guarantee, but it's going to do a lot better than that.
It's probably going to smash that.
Probably going to be like 5.
I mean, tournaments right now are crazy.
Tournaments are sick.
Dude, go look at Triton. Triton just ran a 15K for the event number one, which, of course, Fedor won.
Of course.
And they had 268 runners. That's a lot.
That's pretty good.
That's a lot of runners.
It's more than day one of the 6-max.
It's especially impressive considering that this tournament's taking place in Korea, right?
Well, so many American regs went over.
Well, this is what I mean. Yeah. This is what's impressive. The fact that they've created a festival that is so good that a bunch of Europeans and Americans choose to travel to Korea to play it.
And
right?
It's not even that. You're playing with tougher fields for the most part. So it's like you're traveling to go play tougher fields. But yeah, it looks like they're doing...
Yeah, I'm really...
It looks like a soft field to me.
I'm really impressed, honestly, with Triton. I would love to eventually get myself into one of these fields because they seem like a lot of fun to play.
Yeah. So there was a 20K running, which today they bagged, I think like 38 bagged in the money. Pickleball Dan is still in the mix with 8 big blinds.
Okay.
Let's go Pickleball Dan. I didn't know anybody else's name.
Which Dan is that? Dan Smith?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. There is a lot of Dans.
He's known so far and wide.
When does he go from Pickleball Dan to Cowboy Dan?
He went from Cowboy Dan to Pickleball Dan.
Does it depend on if he has the hat on?
I don't know if he gets to go back to Cowboy Dan.
I think when he has the hat on, he has to be Cowboy Dan, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if he gets to go back to Cowboy Dan. He's now Pickleball Dan.
I mean, a 10-gallon hat is going to just
10-gallon Dan.
Maybe the Council of Dans should decide.
If he wins a Triton event, we're going to call him Triton Dan.
He did win a Triton event.
No, he has to win one this time. We're talking about
not just like the bigger one. No, it's like $3 million or something.
No, we're talking about from here on out, all right? We're not going back. We're not doing that. But Marley put out a new video today, which was it was kind of funny.
She kills it every time.
I didn't watch it yet, but it was like the one make was it making fun of training sites or something?
Always on the fritz. But then I discovered training sites. With 150 times the potency of ZzzQuil, melatonin, and 17 Zanny bars combined, training sites are clinically proven to knock you out fast. Guaranteed to be taught by some guy speaking broken English.
Probing this combo at 15% frequency, it's a low mix.
Before training videos, I used to lie in bed awake for hours, mulling over a marginal bluff catcher I folded in the blinds. Now with training sites, I realized I don't give a shit. And I passed the fuck out.
And if that doesn't work, try our new extra strength training site, ICM. That's right. Dive deep into obscure independent chip model simulations taught by a German cyborg with a bad Wi-Fi connection.
This combo has good unblocking properties.
And you'll sleep like a, well, Philhellmuth.
Roll a low mix.
I bet you buy all kinds of drugs from me.
Also proven effective in improving sleep. Not folded. From the makers of Reading a Book by Candlelight, Bubble Baths, and Bedtime Stories.
Don't look in my jar, please.
Side effects include moderate to severe loss of sex life and actually improving at poker.
Low mix, low mix, low, 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 low.
I actually think that's one of our best work.
That's fantastic. Great.
That's really good.
Mm-hmm. I got Caitlin in there for a cameo.
I want to know who she got to do the German voice, because that was the bit that cracked me up the most. Like, just the little random inserts of just a random German guy.
Probably
fantastic.
Just Google Translate, speak to me.
Can you get Google Translate to speak to you
in a German?
Or something like that. Like some type of AI voice changer.
It probably would be just like, AI, hey, generate me a weird sounding German accent speaking English. And you just give it that and it just gives it to you.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy what AI is doing. Especially with there's about to be like a text to video.
Yep.
It's coming out. It's called Sora or something like that. I'm pretty excited to play
That's
with.
That's crazy. I feel like you guys already talked about Sora on this pod.
We did.
Yeah, we did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sora came out.
Mm-hmm. No, it didn't. It doesn't come out to the public until August. So, or something along those lines.
It's functional. It's just you can't use it yet.
Not for people.
We can't use it. Not the real people.
It's not for you.
So maybe we can get AI to make our training videos and just outsource everything.
Sorry, pigtails. You're out.
Exactly.
You're out.
But we've got to teach AI to play poker first.
They said AI is going to replace people's jobs, so pigtails is first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, us as poker coaches, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be on the chopping block at some point when AI figures out how to actually explain what a solver does.
Mm.
So eventually my job is going to be completely obsolete.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Who knows?
You're just going to have to just play poker.
Yeah, maybe. Or we're going to have to, you know, do it, just ignore the solver and just do whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah.
That's what happens anyways, right?
Yeah, Let's exactly. Go. All
right, well.
Is that a burrito you're eating?
Yeah.
Just eating a burrito, you know, in the middle.
Berkey's not here to yell at him for eating on the pod.
Right?
Just go nuts, man.
He's like, he's on his phone.
Actually, can you put the
burrito,
camera back on?
Like,
let's see a good bite.
No phone, no bite. We don't need a bite.
We need like a Helmuth bite.
I'm trying to be really discreet about it.
No,
that wasn't discreet.
The cat's out of the bag. Let's see. Oh, there we go. That was great.
That was a fucking disgusting bite if I've ever seen one.
That was good. That was Helmuth-esque.
That was definitely Helmuth-esque.
How much molding do you think Berkey's doing right now watching us? Sitting at his table at Bellagio, just
shaking
being like,
his head.
Landon is on his phone. He's eating a burrito. What the fuck
not
is he doing?
Listen, not
when
on my phone.
Not
only
here,
burrito.
We have to fuck with him. I'm surprised there's not like some random tweet out about him shitting his pants.
I completely forgot his computer was over.
Yeah, it's right here.
I didn't make him on a show.
It's right here. You can just come over and do whatever you want. You know?
Not right now.
He has poopy pants in Bellagio. Someone help him.
I can't believe the amount of trust he has in you. He just leaves his computer open.
He
for
just
you
doesn't care.
It's not the trust. It's lack of remembering.
It's lack of. Yeah,
that's true too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. It gives a fuck. What are, you, what are hey, we going to write?
Is the camera still on?
So Burke's not with us today. He's at the Blasio. He got a late call, you know, so he's...
Duty calls.
Captain's chair is empty, so the rest of us are just forced to...
The sidekick, you know, chair, which you are the honorary sidekick today.
I guess I am, yeah. So, I guess I'm the closest one to the chair, so
exactly.
You know, that's how it works.
Exactly. So we are going to be talking about ICM today, and... Mm-hmm. I want you to explain to me, like, I'm five.
Explain to you like you're five.
Yep. Explain to me, like, I'm five, what is ICM today? We're going to take a look at what ICM, the difference between ICM and chip EV differences are, and yeah.
Which means you should go to sleep now.
Night, guys. It's so funny that we played that video now. We're going to be like, all right, here's ICM. We're going to put everybody to sleep. But explain to you like you're five. ICM is how we establish how meaningful chips actually are in a tournament when you're trying to win money, because you're not trying to win chips, you're trying to win money.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody likes to talk about valuing your tournament life in tournaments, or, you know, if return to that Barney Boatman quote from recently, it's your tournament life, it's not your actual life, right? But
yep.
ICM is how we establish how valuable your tournament life really is, right? How much should you care about not busting the tournament? That's what ICM is for, basically.
Okay.
All right. That's the explain like your five version.
But chips, I mean, later not worth
really,
as much.
I guess
as
if you were five,
early,
we'd have to explain what a poker tournament was. We'd have to explain all this other stuff, but, you know.
This is true. All right. Now explain to me the difference between ICM and chip EV. What takes place there?
Okay. So chip EV is essentially what we're referring to as just basic calculations of trying to win chips, right? If every hand was taking place in complete isolation, if there was no context, no tournament, and it was just one hand of poker, chip EV is how do we win the most chips
basically
on that hand.
Basically cash games,
yeah,
right?
So cash games,
you're not going to ever think about ICM in the cash game. You're just trying to win the most amount of chips on every hand.
Precisely, because in a cash game, you can just rebuy if you bust, you can just top up your stack, whatever. Cash games are all about just trying to win the most chips right now. Tournaments, you have to consider, you know, the value of staying alive in the tournament. And that's where we have to have two different mathematical models. Chip EV is the one that says, imagine there's no context and every hand is just happening in a vacuum. ICM is the one that says, this is what the context is. This is the whole tournament. These are what the stack sizes are. And this is how much this amount of chips is actually worth.
And you have to be able to use them both in tournaments. Or at least have a reasonable understanding of both.
It's very useful to have an understanding of the general differences between them. And also how the models themselves work, right? Because ICM it's built off of trying to establish the value of a certain stack based on how likely you are to finish first, second, third, etc. And even though there are a lot of flaws with this model, it's the best that we currently have to establish that relationship between chips and actual dollars. So you have to understand the model and also understand where the flaws are. And what are the aspects that ICM can't really account for? What are the things that it can't do for us? It can't tell us how valuable it is to be better than our opponents or worse than our opponents. It can't tell us very much about, you know, what our position at the table, at a final table, is going to account for. You know, if the best player is to our left versus to our right, it can't tell us all these things. So we have to start using our own intuition to build on top of that. But if you don't have that model, if you don't have any awareness of ICM, then you don't really have any model to start with. You don't have a foundation. You
know? Yeah, I would personally imagine that when it comes to utilizing ICM concepts, it's going to be a lot more beneficial when registration closes.
Mm-hmm.
When, if we can theorycraft a little bit, if people can still buy into the tournament and get more chips, it's almost like chips are relatively infinite.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the rebuy period ends, there is now a finite amount of total chips within the tournament or your flight, if you will. So it also just depends on, like, let's say you're only buying in twice and you don't want to max. And, like, let's say the cap you have is 40 big blinds. And then you get to a level where starting stack is 20 big blinds. You might now have ICM only for you individually versus the entire field. Because if you're not going to rebuy, then this is the last bullet that you have. But if other people can still rebuy, they don't have as much ICM pressure as you do, because they can max and you can't.
And there's you can go even further than that. I had a conversation with a student recently where he lives in an area of the country where there aren't a lot of good tournaments. And he was talking about should you consider, for example, like if a certain tournament is the biggest tournament that's going to happen in your area for the next few months, and you're not going to have very much access to other good tournaments. Like if you're on your second bullet in that event or whatever, and you haven't, your bankroll doesn't allow you to fire a third bullet, and you don't have the option to just like re-enter, and you also don't have the option to just go play a different tournament, should you consider that second bullet to be more valuable overall because it's the most valuable tournament entry that's going to exist for you over the next like however many or well, however long period of time, you know? So it's a really interesting concept because you do start to have these areas where if you are not going to rebuy, but everybody else is, it might be slightly different for you. Your tournament life might be slightly more valuable, or in some cases, maybe it might be slightly less valuable if you are playing an event where everybody else is a really tough player and you satellite it in, right? If you satellite it into an event that you wouldn't usually play, your tournament life is actually worth less than everybody else's because you're one of the weaker players in the field, you know? So there are individual aspects that you can add and kind of build on top of the
people
model.
People probably treat it the other way though, right? Because like say you satellite into the main event or something, it's like, this is like a one-off. I don't want to bust. I want to just cash, you know, just try to like, because just cashing, like if you satellite in for $100 and you just cashed, it's like $15,000 in your pocket.
Sure.
So but like people
speak to Tortoise a couple years ago, baby.
That's sure. Right, man. We spun up $80.
But the consideration there is that you're, and it does change the model that if you're attributing, like basically you're building a strategy where the idea is to maximize the frequency of cashing as opposed to maximize the frequency of winning, right? Mm-hmm. That does change your strategy as a whole.
This is the difference in the Becker and Nye crossbook.
Yeah.
Where mm-hmm. we want the bet to be an ROI based mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
Where cashing does not equal highest ROI.
Yeah.
Right.
Where if you're trying to cash, you just like max mm-hmm. fire and your caches are going to be worth more if under the certain stipulation you already had.
Right. But if you fire 5-10 bullets or whatever, and then you just min cash, mm-hmm. your ROI is negative.
You're right. Your ROI is in the dumpster. But if you only track caches and not rebuys, mm-hmm. then cashing is worth more than
right.
Playing the strategy lets you cash is worth more than playing a strategy.
Right.
That,
exactly. So you can have two different strategies.
ROI.
Yeah. You can have two different approaches to maximize different things, but it's also a question of if you are going to play a strategy that is trying to maximize the frequency of caching, then in some instances, what's going to happen is let's say you're making a decision at the beginning of the event in a relatively big pot, you do have to factor in that winning a big pot earlier in the event is one of the things that might actually massively increase your chances of cashing relative to just trying to kind of small pot your way into the money, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a parlay of you have to win lots of small pots, or maybe, you know, middle of day two, you play a huge pot and you win it. Well, now you might be 80% to cash, right? Something like that. So
where maybe the bluff catcher is worth negative, mm-hmm. but cashing is worth more than
right.
the negative EV of the bluff catcher.
Precisely. So there's like a lot of different theoretical calculations you have to be able to do if you're playing tournaments in a way other than just I'm trying to maximize the money that I make. And at the same time, if you are going to possess a skill disadvantage, then everything that, let's say ICM tells you that with your current stack size, your likelihood of cashing would be about 20%. If you have a skill disadvantage, your likelihood of cashing is actually probably closer to 10 or 15% or something like that, right? So you have to assume that maintaining that stack is less valuable than what it's theoretically supposed to be.
If you're making errors by mm-hmm. not jamming pre or not playing post flop well, mm-hmm. so now there's a bunch of different forces at play.
Right, and this is the weird paradox of ICM that I was thinking about recently. It's actually a little bit like the ICM loop that you came up with the other day, how you get rich and then you don't care about ICM, and then you get poor and now you have to care about ICM. And like, it's a little bit like that where mm-hmm. If you're still studying the game, if you're still learning the game, you might have a skill disadvantage in a lot of the events that you play, which means that the stack that you are playing at any given time is worth less than what ICM says that it should be, especially if you have weaknesses in how you play in the late game. But then once you start to study ICM, once you start to get better at the late game, your stack is worth a little bit more. It's worth closer to what ICM says it's going to be. And especially if you have a skill edge, it's worth more than what ICM says it's going to be. So the more you study, the more you get to a point where you're incentivized to continue playing ICM more and more because your stack is more valuable even than what ICM says. But if you get to a point where you're playing such an ICM heavy style that you're trying to like assume that you have this massive edge and you're just going to pass on every spot because you're so much better than everybody, well, now you're not taking any profitable spots. You're not, you don't have an edge anymore, right? So you get to a point where you no longer have, your stack is not as valuable as what you're saying it is, which incentivizes you to stop trying to avoid all these big spots, right?
Yeah, so there's a mild inflection. Like, this is like the Phil Hellmuth-esque type of approach where he goes very far on one side, but is it actually that bad of an idea if people are, in his quotes, like going to give it to him later?
Yeah.
And where like he's just going to get a profitable spot where maybe those spots shouldn't come up as much as they do.
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, you want a lot.
That's what we don't
back
have
back in the day.
Yeah, that's what we don't have the models for right now. That's the stuff that's mathematically complex enough that we don't have the ability to calculate at this point. You know, eventually, so down the line, we probably will.
But you'll never be able to figure that out like through mathematics, because like we're talking about somebody's skill and like their own personal. Like,
you can always figure it out through math. You can say if your edge is...
You just have to assume an edge.
Right. If your edge is this much big blinds per 100 in chip EV compared to the field, or if your edge is this much percentage of ROI in future hands or something like that, you can always model it using various assumptions. And you can say, well, we don't know what the actual ROI for this person is, or we don't know what the actual chip EV edge for this person is, but if it was this... then they should do this. If it was that, then they should do something else, right?
Okay.
So you can definitely model it, or at least we will be able to model it in the future. We just can't right now because it's ridiculously complex.
Okay. So if you're at a final table and you're pretty sure that you have a skill edge over the field, or maybe you're the best player, one of the best players, then doing an ICM chop is actually bad for you.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're taking the worst of it.
Yeah, exactly. If you are, let's say there's five players left and you're going to chop it up, ICM wise, every player is going to realize their ICM EV. So every player is going to get the amount that ICM tells them their stack is worth. But if you play that out 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, whatever, the players with the bigger edges are going to over realize the value of their stack. They're going to win more than what ICM says they're going to win.
Right.
So in theory, if you're the best player left out of five, you always want to play it out. But you may not always want to take on the variance of that, because if it's a massive amount of money in comparison to your bankroll, you don't just want to flip for half your bankroll.
Or convince the other players that you are the better player and you deserve more than ICM.
Well, this is the thing.
That's
like,
hard to do,
this
though.
This is the paradox of it, right?
Because everyone thinks they're the best player.
Anytime you're in a position where you actually are the best player relative to the other players, they're pretty unlikely to give up an amount to you in a chop that incentivizes you to chop.
Right.
And conversely, anytime where you're in a position where you want to chop because you know that you're the weakest player, let's say, it's very unlikely that they're going to agree to a chop, because they're probably going to know, if they're better than you, they're probably going to know they're better than you, which means they're probably not going to agree to chop.
Unless you're Shannon Shore and Fareed in the Florida main when they chop.
That was wild. I mean, you do hear these occasional stories of people like chopping for more than first place or something, like weird shit like that. But like
plus 60K, plus 20K, minus 60, minus
10. Yeah.
So like when you see some of these absurd chops and people are like, oh, they just fleeced this person, like... Actually, maybe they didn't. Like, if they're that much better, maybe they got them for a percentage, but maybe it's not like as bad as you think.
It's not even in the sense of like as bad or what it looks like. Where if somebody is like caught aware of the skill set differential and the money is worth so much, because the difference in like theory land and real life land is that money means something. Like the machine will just auto rebuy, auto play really well, and win the most theoretical dollars. But when you're in a spot as a human playing for six figures and
you don't get these spots
every so, you get the spot if you're lucky once every couple years.
Yeah.
Where like taking a chop here versus getting fourth for like 200 versus chopping for 420, like that could be very different to your lifestyle overall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where now you probably should take the worst end of the deal.
Yeah.
And even though you're getting like fleeced in some ways, you're sustaining for a little while.
Especially like maybe you have makeup and now this chop puts you in profitville, so you're actually going to put money in your pocket as opposed to just breaking, just getting back to even. And then, yeah, so there's so many other factors.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, if you were looking at this whole idea of real world money actually being meaningful, it's real important world. because if you were starting out your poker career at 21 and you have infinite money to play with, if you just don't care about money, you're, I don't know, whatever, you have some billionaire trust fund or something, doesn't matter. If you were to start out saying, I want to be the biggest bracelet winner, the strategy for winning the most bracelets across your career, if you have infinite money, is very different from the strategy for, I want to maximize the amount of money that I make and I'm starting out from low stakes. Because like Landon said earlier, if you were just trying to win the most bracelets, you would max fire every single tournament. You would take a lot of negative EV spots in the early game to just try to flip yourself to a big stack. And that would mean that once you get to that big stack, you would have a very high chance of cashing and going deep, etc. But you'd be spending so many buy-ins getting there that you'd actually be losing money. You could easily final table an event and still be losing money if you're just firing off in the early stages.
You could win the most bracelets of all time and just lose infinite money.
Precisely,
playing the WSOP.
Yeah. You could quite easily be in that position. Like
basically paying for marketing.
Yeah, in a hypothetical kind of modeled environment, you could come up with a strategy to do that. You could find a way to be a successful bracelet winner who loses money. But obviously on the other side of the coin, like, real world money does mean something. Almost nobody is playing with just unlimited resources, and people want to play in a way that's actually profitable and sustainable. So we have to build strategies that are based around the fact that we care about real world money and we care about elements of risk and how much variance we're exposed to and all sorts of things.
It's kind
like
of
that.
The funny part about poker as a whole is you play this really good strategy to at one point exit the arena to become the whale that just gets to play however they want in any tournament anyways.
Right. Yeah.
That's the dream, right? Like, you play poker, you make $100 million, and like, you know what? I don't need to care about this shit anymore.
Just become the whale. Yeah.
You play to become the whale. The whale's already have it made.
This is why ICM is for poor people.
That's right.
Because you only have to care about it if you're poor, you know?
Or if you're not extremely rich.
If you've already won all the money, you don't have to give a shit anymore.
Right.
You can just, you know, play PLO and gamble it up every time.
You're kind of hidden behind the camera.
Oh,
there.
Shit, yeah.
Sounds like a dream.
It's like, well, a good example being in chip EV, if you look at the wizard here, we'll see that the chip EV for an average stack of 40 bigs is 17.5%. And we're not using Queen Jack off very much, kind of a bad hand. This is going to be 8-handed ranges, right? Seven-handed ranges.
So what Landon's going to do is going to demonstrate the difference between chip
it's
EV.
Eight. There's no big blind. It's 8-handed ranges.
He's going to demonstrate the difference between chip EV and ICM.
Right. Yes. Or ICM is what we believe to be true.
Yes.
So we see here from the under the gun range, we're going to be opening for chip EV like ace 10 off bottom, king jack off a lot, fold out queen jack, some suited stuff here and there, but not really, just because these hands aren't as good at 40 as they are at 80 mm-hmm. or 100 for board coverage purposes, where at the stack depth, if you make a good top pair like a king or an ace, you could potentially just find your way to be all in.
Yep.
So we'll see here you play 17.5%, and the important part is knowing like this number on the bottom, because we'll see how that changes, where in this one we'll see the ICM 25% of the field left. Now we're playing 15.6%. So now we're playing less hands, and we're removing the suited stuff. We're removing the weaker King X stuff.
The Fantastic Four.
The Fantastic Four is gone. They're not good anymore.
The Fantastic Four is anymore. The suited connectors, right?
Yeah, not yeah, so okay. Fantastic anymore.
Can you please great. Explain the Fantastic Four?
No, I know. I know what it is.
No, you need to know each one, though.
This is Mr. Fantastic. Okay. This is the Human Torch. This is the Thing, and that's Invisible Woman.
Nice.
So there we are.
Okay.
So anyways, you're mostly going to play like blocker intensive hands, like hands that prevent you from getting three bet. Hands like King High, Ace High, the Ace Wheels and up are very good, and then like King 8 suited.
Yeah, I think the best example here is that if you look at 7-6 suited, like which one was 7-6 suited? Which one of the Fantastic Four is that?
That is the Thing.
That's the Thing. Okay, so we look at the Thing here. In Chip EV, it was opening a little bit at 40,
the
right?
The Thing is in.
Yeah, but in ICM, it's not. And then you look at Ace Deuce suited, which to my knowledge doesn't have a comic book name.
No.
Ace Deuce suited is pure fold in Chip EV, but it starts to open when you look at ICM. And it's simply because having a high card, having a blocker to some of the hands that 3-bet you is really valuable. You take the pot down a little bit more often pre-flop, and we don't care as much about board coverage. We just care about winning the pot a little bit more often pre in exchange for you know, not having to, like, maybe we're a little bit less covered on like a 7-6 deuce flop, but we don't care that much about that.
Right. And when we see here 25% of the field left means that nobody's cashed yet. So this is approaching the bubble-esque where you're getting close to the money, but you still kind of have to win some pots and fight for some things. But now when we look at the 5% left, which means you're in the money and you're like caught on the way to making some pay jumps, but not final three tables, not final two tables. This is just 200 man fields, 5% left. So what is that? What is that? 5% left of 200. 40 people?
10.
10 people.
Yeah, this is basically fine. Well,
oh, shit. Wait, what the hell?
This is 1,000 man fields.
Oh, this is, sorry. This is, yeah, this, yeah, is the 1,000 man field one.
1,000 man fields with 50 left.
Yeah, so this is 50 left. So, like, you're getting down to important stuff, but at the same time, you still have to take chances. And we'll see here with 5% of the field left in a 1,000 man field, you're actually raising more than with ICM 25 with 15%. Percent open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because there's less pressure as you've made money and you're not approaching any like serious pay jumps yet, but you still also have to try to win some hands. We're folding ace deuce again, where it's not as good in the other scenario because we want to have high card blocks, and we're opening more hands that can play well post, like jack nine suited, some queen jack off back in there a little bit. And I mean, you can kind of remove this if you really want to, but you're opening a little bit more than you used to. And that's kind of the difference between being in the money versus almost approaching the money.
Yeah. And I think people really, most of all, I think people don't necessarily recognize the extent to which while, like, once we get into the money, you start to shift a lot more back towards chip EV. I think people are a little bit too inclined to think about it in the money as a whole as being like, this is like the important part of the tournament, when in reality, the point between the bubble and like the last few tables, there's not a ton of ICM factors a lot of the time.
Right. And you're then just trying to make chips, build a stack again.
Yeah.
Try to take some flips if you need to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other part of it is that this is the area, or at least to me, where the unknown aspects of future game start to become really important in ways that we can't yet measure, right? So we can't yet accurately measure how important it is to, let's say, win a pot that gives you the chip lead with 32 players left or
it's
something.
It's kind of the navigator approach where it's like, is this spot worth jamming over the raise? Where in theory it would, but in practice, these guys aren't as good as the machines. Mm-hmm. So maybe I play a call because the risk premium for me in this spot is going to be different than other people's, or
right,
what it looks like in theory. Mm-hmm. Where you play like a 25K high roller where there's not that many dead spots. You have to take a spot,
yeah,
but you're playing in a less tough field. Mm-hmm. And now you're thinking, okay, what is their range? Their RFI range look like in the first place? Mm-hmm. Where now if they're raising too tight and now I jam a combo, I might be making a big mistake.
Right. And you can also look at it. It also works in the inverse sometimes, where if you're playing a field where it's relatively top heavy in terms of payouts and you have an opportunity to take a spot where there's 30 left, let's say, and when you win this flip or whatever, you now have the chip lead and it's a field of primarily rec players or players that are playing relatively tight, maybe stacks are fairly deep. You know, you're just gonna, when you have the chip lead, you're gonna be able to like run over the table quite well. In that instance, the upside of winning, it's hard to say whether it might actually outweigh the downside of losing because we still don't have a model to explain this, like I mentioned, but it's very reasonable to assume that there's a lot of value in simply taking the chip lead at that point because of how many good spots it gives you later on.
Right.
And there's other stuff that you can consider on top of that. You can consider, like, let's say there is one other really good player left in the event and that player has a relatively short stack. Well, if you have a big stack, you might actually be in a position where you have a slight incentive to call a little bit wider against that player because busting that individual player has a high impact on your overall ROI because that player is the only other player that's going to give you really tough spots left in the event. Now, obviously, that's a really unique circumstance, but you can start to factor it in to some degree, especially if you're at a final table and there's like five left and one of them is like Chidwick, right? Like busting Chidwick in that spot is going to count for a lot.
Yeah.
Yep. So now, like, we can quickly move to another pre-flop example. It's like still 40 effective, but now we're opening the button, and this is like a chip EV open on the button where you're playing more than half the hands in the deck. You're playing some offsuit garbage. You're playing some high card block stuff, and that's not really that important. I call it the king 5-0, where if you open that from under the gun eight-handed, you're lighting it, but on the button, there's only the small blind and the big blind behind, so we try. So this is what it looks like for Chip EV, and now if we look at 25% left, we'll see there's a drop-off where now king 5 off is a bad idea, 7-8 off, 10-7 off, 5-3 suited. Some of these hands that you can open for chips now become less appealing as chips are going to be worth more. So like removing 4% of your opening range, where when you're opening on the button, you're opening 688 combos, like 690. And now you're opening 640. So you're opening 50 combos less, but those combos stem from the bottom in all of the spots. Like Jack Deuce suited with opens for Chip EV doesn't open anymore. 8-7 doesn't open anymore. But you still want to use the high card blocker hands like Ace X always in these spots, as the ace is going to make it less likely that you get 3-bet. Because if you look at a button open, we'll see that the small blind likes to 3-bet with aces in their hand. So if you have an ace, it's less likely you're going to get 3-bet.
Yeah, I think these small blind spots are a really good example of how Chip EV and ICM differ from each other. Like if you look at 40 in the small blind against button open, you're going to start to see some jams. You're going to start to see that there's a decent portion of hands that are like mixing 3-bets because we need to have more playability in our 3-betting range because we're getting flatted quite a bit. And we're not going quite as polar with our 3-bets. We're okay with flatting stuff like queen 5 suited, king 3 suited here. There's a lot of flatting going on. We're even flatting some of those offsuit aces. But as soon as you switch to ICM, you really see that a lot of that drops out. The offsuit aces never flat now. They play pure 3-bet or fold.
Jams go away.
The jams basically disappear. A lot of the offsuit hands in general are much more preferring to 3-bet instead of flatting. And a lot of the suited broadways, they don't have as much reason to 3-bet because they don't get peeled as much by the button. The button folds a bit more. And the suited broadways also really hate getting jammed on. So in general here, we're just going much more polar as soon as ICM starts to come into the equation, because flatting 3-bets doesn't happen as much. We don't have to have as much playability in a 3-bet pot, and it's not as much of a priority to get thin value from those suited broadway hands.
Right. We'll look and see here for Chip EV. When small blind does 3-bet, the button is going to play a good amount of calls, I imagine. Like we're calling a lot of calls and a lot of jams, like 12% still a lot. We're jamming the hands that need the most protection and value, like deuces and threes. Sometimes these middling pairs, like sevens and eights, like eights is the mix, and jamming these pure is never going to be that big of a deal. But the reason why you want to call five and sixes is because they're going to induce with eights plus. Right. So just jamming fives to get called by eights isn't really that thrilling.
Yeah. When you jam fives, they never call off fours, but they never fold like sixes or sevens if they 3-bet it.
Right. And now if we look at the ICM 25, when we see a small blind raise, we'll see that the button is probably going to call less. So now we're calling 16% of the time instead of 45.
Calling much less.
So now what we're under... Oh, sorry, this is the wrong one. So now what we're doing is we're playing more jams. We're playing more like polar clicks. And we're also folding more because now when we get 3-bet, a hand like king 10 off isn't very fun. It's just like, oh, great. Like, chips are worth a lot. My hand kind of sucks. And if I make a pair, I can still be out of the tournament. So now we're folding a lot more when it comes to ICM. And then we're playing a lot more jams when it comes to the suited king X version, where if we know that the small blind is going to be 3-betting a lot of these offsuit ace X's, we want to take our suited hands, like king X suited, and be like, you know what, like you could have us beat. We are flipping a lot. I do block like the good traps, like queens, mm-hmm. kings, an ace king. So I'm all in.
Right.
I'm all in. And if you want to call, like we're going to flip a lot. We'll see here, like the small blind response, they're going to have a lot of these pairs. And they're going to have some, like, ace-jack being the bottom. So, like, you're going to be a 40-60 against that, but welcome to life. And you also get a fold from, like, these offsuit ace-x region that is, like, the main driver of why mm-hmm. we want to use the suited king.
It's really, when ICM's in play, it's really nice to have a suited broadway and get, like, a random ace to fold.
Yep.
It's just really beneficial because you just theoretically have less than 50% equity and you're not in a position where you being in position post-flop counts for enough that you have, like, that you want to make them play out of position post with it, right?
The stack depth is shallow enough, and we'll see here for Chippy V, we're like, you know what, like, we don't care. Like, we're going to just make our 3.4 bigs and then just call you and see what the flop is and play in position. But when chips are worth more, it's like, you know what? I hope that you have, I hope you're bluffing. Like, I hope you have the ace X off. I hope you have, I don't really hope you have eights and we're flipping, but I hope you fold because now I just win this 9.35 bigs in the middle because the big blind folded plus the ante. So you're just winning so much. Like, you're risking 40 to win back 50 because you get your 40 back and then you're hoping that they fold.
Yeah.
And if they call, like, you're like, well, this sucks, but we're going to be fine.
Right.
You could win the flip and have a ton of chips now.
Right. And I think the thing that people really, I think, get wrong about these spots is that they think the ICM means you hedge by calling.
And right, you don't want to risk it all, right, so you like, play peel.
Exactly. They think, okay, we'll just, I'm not going to jam my king-queen suited here. I'm just going to peel because it that way I can get away from it if it's a bad spot, right? But the problem is then you don't realize all your equity and your opponent gets to push you off the hand in instances where they do have the bottom of their range. So in reality here, what ends up happening is that there are much fewer hands that actually have the incentive to just call. And instead, we prefer to play a jam with a lot of stuff or just fold in a lot of cases. So these pairs are jamming because set mining isn't that valuable, but we obviously realize all our equity when we jam and we get called by ace king. So that's a really important point that I think people miss. I think people tend to hedge by just like, I think people's response in practice is like wider than ICM, but tighter than chip EV in that I don't think they flat like the queen five suited against the three bet here, but I also don't think they jam like the suited broadways and stuff. I think they just peel those. And so it ends up in this weird space where they're not really following either of the two models correctly.
And like, I guess a good example where you don't really want to just like take ace wheel to the face would be like the spot where you see like ace three, ace four, ace, like ace three mostly folding, kind of jamming here and there a little bit, just depending on how much is the small blind going to be bluffing with a four and a five in their hand, right? Because when we look at the small blind three bet, we'll see like king four is in there a lot, ace four, ace five off. So now you don't actually want to have a suited wheel to play as a jam.
You dominated a lot,
but you do want to play them as a call because you do keep in those worse hands as well as do fine versus the polar three bet where they're going to have a lot of this king x suited and they're going to have a lot of these broadways where now we're risking a lot where if we did get induced by queens, we only have an over and that's kind of kind of stinky.
The what it comes down to is this is an example of a spot where you prefer not to have an ace when you jam, when you four bet jam from the button. That's why you prefer to have a pair or a suited Broadway type hand because the small blind is three bet bluffing with so many ace X offsuit hands that you, like, as soon as you have an ace in your hand, you massively reduce the likelihood of being up against a bluff.
Right. So now we're going to look at the 5% of the field left. So 50 tables left type thing. We open
50 players left.
50 players. Not 50 tables.
50 tables is a lot of players.
A lot of players.
That's main event.
Yeah, that's main event. Yeah. Main event, 5%. Main event 5%, you'll never see king four. So it's like this is the small blind three bet. Once again, it kind of looks very similar to the other one where we'll see they're three betting 16%, which is actually a ton of the time. Like,
this is a high frequency three bet.
Yeah, like you're
people are not finding these. Like,
So here it's 17%, in this spot it's 16. So same idea, same combos as well. Right, you'll see the king x suited, you'll see the ace lows, and the ace x off suits are going to be a very big portion of the range. And then sometimes for some board coverage, as well as unblocking the 9x off. So you see here, the button's going to open 10-9, jack-9, queen-9, king-9. We see here for the small blind, we want to have these suited 8s sometimes because the suited 8s make it more likely that they have the offsuit 9 that dominates us. So we 3-bet these jack-8s to get jack-9 off the fold and get queen-9 off the fold. And that's great for us. So now we'll see here if the small blind 3-bets. The button is going to play jams with roughly the same hands, like the suited paint. King queen, you're a little bit more incentivized to call again, as there's less ICM pressure in the sense of getting that initial min cash. So now you can start playing peels again.
This is a weird sim. Does it have like an almost all in size there? Is that like the?
It's basically all 30, in.
Yeah.
It's like 39.940. I don't really know what's going on here.
Yeah, it's a weird size to have.
It's keeping one chip back.
Yeah, it's keeping it. Yeah, just in case you get jammed on, you might be able to fold.
Yeah.
So, like we'll see here. We're calling more of the time now. We're back to calling 25% instead of 16. We're now playing post flop is not necessarily incentivized, but we can't just give it up as we could in the other spot. So now we have to fight a little bit more with the high Broadway cards where at this SPR, we're more concerned about flopping a pair and going with it than we are with some connectivity. Like, we'll see, like, the suited paints kind of get out of the, or the suited gappers get out. Suited connectors you can still be in with. But then, like, 6-7 is a better hand than Jack-8. And that's because your pairs are more live. Your pair plus draws are going to be more live. And if you have a Jack, it's likely that it interferes with the small blind 3-bets, like Ace-Jack, King-Jack, Queen-Jack. And that's not going to be very good for us when we're trying to make a pair and we're dominated.
Let me paraphrase a question from somebody in the chat.
Yeah.
Kurt says, basically, let's say we're approaching ICM in a tournament and nobody around you understands what ICM is. Mm-hmm. How does this influence our strategy?
Well, I think the first thing to be aware of is that ICM is all about the value of your stack. And so it's not dependent on your opponent's strategy in a vacuum, right? If your opponents are playing bad, then your stack is going to be more valuable than what it's theoretically supposed to be. But it doesn't mean that when they're not playing ICM, you shouldn't play ICM, right? Because ICM is a strategy based on the idea that at a certain point in the tournament, your stack has a certain value. So you might look at it and say, okay, well, my opponents are not playing ICM, therefore, that means maybe they are not folding as much as they're supposed to. And if that's the case, what that's going to mean is that bust outs are going to happen faster than what they're supposed to theoretically. So in reality, that incentivizes you to play more of an ICM strategy because it means your stack is more valuable than what it's supposed to be, right? Now, on the flip side, if your opponents were not playing ICM and don't have any idea about what ICM even is, but they're playing so tight that they're actually playing even tighter than what ICM is supposed to play, which actually happens quite a bit, then now you're in a position where you're incentivized to just focus on taking down pots against all these really tight players. And your stack is valuable, but it's only valuable if you actually take advantage of all those good spots.
Right. Like, a good example of this would be the bubble of something like the main event,
where
everybody wants to cash, everybody wants to make the money and and say that they cashed the main event because it's like the greatest accomplishment of all time, obviously.
Yeah.
So in that spot, when you have a chip lead at your table, you want to be extremely relentless when it comes to opening and trying to play the low variance spots of like the friends and I, we call it serve and returns, where like you just, you put out the raise, someone defends big blind, you see bet and they fold. Right?
Yeah.
Like you serve and then they return and then you win. You want to play more of those spots where if people aren't trying to fight back against it, you just open a lot. And if you get three bet, you can start folding a lot and be like, you know what? The money was made by opening.
Yeah.
The money wasn't made by trying to open ace wheel and they three bet you and you're like, oh, this guy's three betting me because I'm opening so wide. Now I'm all in. And then they call and then they have kings. And you're like, how do they have kings when they only three bet queens plus?
Exactly.
So it's just a more intimate understanding of the environment and how is the environment going to play back. Where in a lot of ICM spots, and you'll see this at final tables, you'll see this like final two tables where less final two, more final table. But if someone has a ton of chips, their job is to open a lot. And the other stacks are incentivized to attack through playing three bets and jams.
Yeah.
Right? So when you start seeing that stuff happen, you're like, okay, my job is to open a lot. Their job is to let me steal pots. And they're not trying to play back. And when they play back, my job is to have a good hand the rare amount of times that I do and click call.
Yeah.
Damn,
yeah.
You actually seem like you know how to exploit bad players.
Depends who you ask.
Nah. I mean, reaction. Yeah, relax, bro.
Anyways,
your bags aren't filled yet? I thought your bags were
filled. Bags are filled.
Bags are never ended, you know? Bags are never ended. Line moves, man. And listen, Becker recently.
He's the one giving away all his strategies.
Dude, Becker just fucking bagged the 600 at Venetian. He's sitting here on the podcast talking about how he busted three times.
That's true.
So, you know, it sounds like.
Plus 180.
That's all I hear. I hear about plus 180, right?
Lines have moved. That was very funny when Lotus made a tweet saying a lot of people say that the lines have moved. It's like you're making up information on the internet.
That's funny. I the one pot I played against Becker the other day, he called the river against me and lost. And he was like, oh, the line just moved.
the lines moved.
That's actually pretty funny. All right, guys, we're going to get out of here because I know you two got to get the battle. You got to make day two of this thing. I got to pack my shit. I'm going to Horseshoe, Chicago, Indiana. I don't fucking know.
You don't know where you're going.
I'm going to Hammond. That's where I'm going.
All right. He's going far, far away.
Conrad, plug those academies.
Oh, those academies, yes. All right, well, the manager, that is your job because you know some dates.
That's right. We got a Cash Game Academy coming up in May. It is May 23rd to the 25th right here in Las Vegas, followed by the Tournament Academy that's going to be hosted by none other than Mr. Matt Hunt, and that'll be the May 27th to the 30th. And get your seats because they're filling fast. Go to academy.solve4y.io to sign up or for more information.
Jill is also running a dealer academy. She has a couple dates in Las Vegas, a couple dates in Atlanta. Go check it out on solve4y.io. You can find all the links there.
Exactly.
Thank you for rocking with us, guys. Berkey will be back tomorrow running the show. Well, because I'm not here, obviously, so Sidekick's got to step up. The guy's got to step up.
He's got to do something.
Yeah, yeah, you know, not a fucking 10 a.m. text. Hey, can you run the show? What do you mean? I run the show every day. Like, well, fuck out of here. All right, anyway, thanks for joining, rocking with us. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Later.
Peace.
Peace.